And I even reported somebody recently, and she came back the next day, and she was angry. Oh. And I was afraid to respond. And she said, I was not. And I said, well, yeah, you were. And then after that, I just let her rant for a while. And she left, and she also told me she'd never work with me again.
This is Best Aging Podcast with Wendy Wiedner and Josh Casper. Brought to you by WJCW Media, LLC.
Welcome back. Wendy, welcome. Thank you for coming back another week.
We made it to episode 2.
We did. And I want to say, as nervous as I was week 1, I'm still nervous today, but it's fun. Today is...
Well, of course it's fun. I'm here.
And, you know, I'm thinking back about us talking and bantering and being able to talk through difficult situations and figuring out how to deal with them. And we were doing that 22 years ago. And I remember back, there was a time when we were working there, and I don't know if you remember, but when we were told not to talk anymore together, how long was it that we were told not to talk to each other, that we were talking to each other about being told not to talk to each other?
Oh, 30 seconds. I came right in and said, I'm not supposed to talk to you anymore.
I believe you sat down right after that and talked
to
me.
We talked.
22 years later, still talking.
Yep, we are.
And this is episode number 2 of Best Aging. And I think today will be the best episode we've ever done before.
Or at least second best.
I'm excited today. Both of us are resident focused, senior focused.
Always.
And today we have a soon to be 70-year-old resident of an assisted living who is going to be sharing with us her experiences as a resident, as an advocate caregiver for her mom.
And as a former nursing assistant in a nursing home. So she's seen all sides of these issues.
She really does bring the complete circle to us to be able to share that comprehensive view with us.
Yeah, to really get her perspective on what it's from her viewpoint now, which is totally different than when she started in long-term care.
So this is going to be episode number 2. Just so as you're listening to our podcast today, there won't be a podcast the week of the 4th of July. We'll be on vacation. And the 3rd podcast will be coming out on July 11th. So we're looking forward to being back with you then. But right now, I think we should welcome Peggy and get started with her. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm delighted to be with you.
And Wendy is here with us as well.
Yes, I am.
We're going to be going through today, Peggy, and a little bit about you is that I believe you turned 70 in September. And you currently live in an assisted living.
That's correct. I am in the enhanced assisted living. Well, 40 years ago, I was a nursing assistant, both in a couple of hospitals and nursing homes that no longer exist. And when I was in my 30s, I was a senior payroll clerk. And then my complex neurological condition was finally diagnosed after 20 years of searching for answers. And my neurologist said, Peggy, go back to school. So I completed my associate degree at Normandale, bachelor's degree in psychology, University of Minnesota, and my master's degree in counseling and student development at the university as well. And I found my passion, which was being an academic advisor at the U. And most of my students were interested in, you know, having a psychology degree, but they wanted to go on to one of the health sciences. But I also found my passion, which was the Brave New Workshop. I went to a few shows there. And then a few years after that, I started volunteering there. I worked in the box office, and then I also processed requests for ticket donation.
Well, I'm curious, Peggy, in your job as a nursing assistant early in your career, Did you feel connected to the residents?
Yes, very much so. Friendly, being positive, taking good care, not scolding them. I mean, just really easy things that can make the day for somebody. Even I worked days and evenings. Most of the time I was, you know, working overnight, and even those connections were very positive. In the middle of the night, people are, you know, scared. They don't want to put their light on. They're embarrassed because maybe, you know, they wet their pants. And just say, well, you know, it's okay. Everybody goes through that at some point, and let me help you. And when I was working days, we'd go in a room and you'd talk to the person. Oh, hi, how are you doing today? It's Thursday. It's lovely outside. And the other thing I would do would be to ask the resident about, you know, their families. You know, did you have any children? What are they doing? And, you know, just finding out more about them.
Yeah.
And notice was, how people like to share their stories. And, you know, several of them had immigrated, you know, from various places, and they love relaying that. And they lived, you know, through World War II, and they like talking about that, you know, what it was like for them with their, you know, husband overseas, or their, you know, how they were affected by it, you know, maybe, and, you know, growing up in the Depression. And so it was nice listening to that. And it kind of reminded me of my grandparents.
Nice.
Prior to being in the assisted living, where were you living?
I was living in my home. I lived alone. My physical condition was deteriorating, and I could not find nor afford, you know, in-home help. So I had great neighbors, and they, you know, helped me. My brother and his wife were close by, so they would help out. But, you know, I could never find anybody overnight, and I did need, you know, more care than I, you know, like I said, be able to find or afford. So it was a difficult decision. And then especially it was shown that in 2016, I had sepsis, and my health fell apart after that. I think the worst was I developed critical neuropathy, which it took probably 2.5 years to recover from that. And during that time, I, you know, finally realized that I could not keep up with the house. My house deserved better than I could give it. And so with assistance from my sister and sister-in-law, we visited a few places and found one that seemed to be a good fit. I hadn't done much investigating of places prior to this. And the first two, you know, people weren't, it's not like they were, you know, bad so much as they weren't happy. They had blank faces, you know, residents just sitting around. But when we went to this one place, people were, you know, they were interacting with each other. They'd come up to us at the door and say, this is a great place. You know, this is a place for you. And it's nice to have residents just come out there with it rather than hearing the sales talk. The food there was fabulous. And even the dietary manager came up to us and, you know, asked about, you know, what kind of food I like. Do they have any dietary restrictions or preferences? Here's what we can do for you. And then other things like, you know, activities. So it was very good.
And is that the facility that you're currently in?
No, I've been in 4 facilities back and forth, saying as in progress, and then something would happen and I'd have to go through, you know, rehab again and again.
Yeah.
And it reached the point where the nursing director said, well, we're not going to support you until, you know, you agree to be in care suite. And that was very expensive. And I didn't want to be in a care suite. So they eventually, when I ran out of money, they did not offer elderly waiver. So then the next place I moved to, great food, same kind of thing. They were, you know, very conscientious about making sure that my dietary needs were met. They also had great dining room staff. And that's been the case with every place I've been at, is dining services are very well trained and very cheerful and knowledgeable. So this third place I was at, I was in assisted living and then had to move to care suite, which did not take the elderly waiver. So then I left there and found the place I'm at now.
Okay.
And I'm in enhanced assisted living.
Okay. To me, that sounds like a very typical journey.
7 different teams we used, and probably a total of 16 or 17 times that I had to be in the transitional care unit.
Yeah, they have to, sometimes they have to move around for health reasons and for financial reasons. If a facility doesn't take assistance in helping a resident pay for services or pay for rent, right, then you have to find a place that does because of those reasons.
I think one of the other common things, at least in Minnesota, that Peggy, I don't know if you knew when you first moved in, but even facilities that take elderly waiver, is the requirement that you private pay for 2 years before they'll accept elderly waiver. Is that the case for you, Peggy, or?
I know some facilities that do that. I private pay, and we think that was the second place I was at. And the third place, I did not have to have the private pay. I don't. And where I'm at now, no, I did not have to have 2 years in.
One of the pieces I'm wondering about going back in time is when you were younger, what did best aging, you know, if you were going to describe what best aging would look like to you, what would your later life look like to you when you were younger, and how has that changed over time?
Well, when I was younger, I looked forward to, you know, being healthy and active. I didn't ever envision having the health difficulties I had. And I also saw myself having a lot of, you know, family support. But my grandmother had been in a nursing home, and that was in the 60s, and it was really a dump. And I guess she was treated okay. Although I recall one time she told my mother that they had not gotten her up that day. And my mom called the administrator and said, why wasn't, you know, grandma gotten up? And they said, well, they just didn't have anybody to do it. Oh. I thought, well, I hope that's not going to be the case where staffing is an issue. Yes, it's an issue everywhere with keeping, especially nursing assistants.
What do you remember from your first day in long-term care, your first day in the assisted living?
Oh, right away I missed my house, but I knew I had to do it. People were very friendly. You know, that aspect of it was good. They were interested in me, I felt. And, you know, would ask how I was doing, if there was anything, you know, any way to make it easier for me. So that was nice.
Peggy, I'm wondering if you had to describe what quality care would look like to you.
Well, that's a toughie. I think it's not just about, you know, having staff that, you know, put on a happy face and say, well, how's your day? And it's Thursday, it's beautiful, but contrasting with what the reality is, being, you know, just friendly and answering questions. I ask eight questions and they will not say anything at all. So to me, there's the part where just, you know, how the aide comports himself. Are they, you know, are they reaching out at all? Having my call light answered, you know, within a certain period of time. I don't expect instant service, but I've had to wait sometimes hour and a half. I would like people who actually are interested in serving this population, you know, who serve with joy, and especially people who notice things, who, you know, can look at, oh, gee, here's a red area, or how are you feeling, or they're, you know, conscientious. They're looking for issues. They notice things. You really need to be observant in this kind of job, and so many are not.
Does that make you feel isolated or disconnected from the rest of the world?
You mean the facility or how the aides?
Well, how the aides are responding to you or not responding to you. How does that make you feel?
Sometimes frightened, because I'm being ignored when I might have an issue or something. And here, as in a lot of assisted living, the aides pass medication. They go through a short course. Mm-hmm. But there have been problems getting the meds on time, even given that there's, you know, an hour window. to give them, I received them like 2.5-3 hours late. And there have been many times that I haven't received a certain medication at all, even and then been told that, you know, it's not there, or they don't see it on a list. And I said, I know it's there. Here's where it is. And so I asked if I could administer my own pills. And finally, I was approved. Because that gives me a lot more flexibility. And I wonder, people who aren't, you know, able to, you know, do their own meds, or, you know, don't recognize when they're missing something, what's really happening.
Right, right.
I mentioned this to the nursing staff. And from there, I don't know what I can do. I just know that I can look out for myself and say, you know, well, I'm missing this or that. The nurses are setting up my meds. I just take them.
Right. What can you tell us, what happens if nobody answers your call for assistance?
Oh, depending upon who I am, I might start yelling. If I'm in bed, no, I'll just wait it out. But sometimes I've been, say, sitting on the toilet and waiting quite a while, and then I'll just start yelling because I don't know what else to do.
Right. What's the longest you waited?
Oh, while I was on the toilet?
Yeah.
I had to think back because it was the first place I was at, and I waited 2 hours.
Oh, my.
And I needed help standing up. Otherwise, I would have done it myself. And the longer I was sitting there, the more difficult it was to try to get up. And, you know, when I first got on, you know, she was helping me. And she said she'd come back. And she never did. And so I thought, well, I don't want to put my light on. She told me she was coming back. Because every time I put my light on, it meant that I was going to get a charge.
Did you ever put the light back on, Peggy? And did it work, or did you still have to wait?
Yes, I still waited a little bit.
I'm wondering if you've ever had to seek help.
Yes, I did contact the ombudsman about a situation I had in a rehab facility, and he was fabulous. You know, he listened to what I had to say. He came out to the facility. He, you know, asked me if I wanted anybody with me. My niece came, and plus the director of nursing and the nurse manager were there. We discussed the situation, and there was resolution. And I had called him subsequent to that with some other issues. And he was always very responsive. He retired not too long after that. And I missed him because in my journey throughout these various places, you know, some things have come up that are recurrent in every place. And I know he could have helped.
When you say him and retired, I think you're referring to Jim, correct?
Yes.
And so I'm glad he was able to help you in it. But on the other hand, it doesn't surprise me at all because he helped everyone he worked with. So
he's a passionate man.
Yes. And it wasn't, I mean, there was this one issue that was, just with me, but then it's pervasive about the lack of infection control and how that's, I mean, despite being told that it's not taken lightly, it is taken lightly. Otherwise, it would have been corrected by now. And that's, like I said, been every facility with, for example, equipment is not clean between residents, and the same crud that's on, I use a lift, an electric lift, and there's, you know, a place to put my hand. And the same crud is on there now that was on there, you know, a couple weeks ago because it's not clean. And when they leave here, and despite the aides telling me, no, we clean it all the time. Well, no, you don't. But I can't say anything for fear of retribution. That they only do one resident's laundry at a time. It's not mixed. Well, then why am I getting somebody else's underwear? And why am I missing clothes?
When you talk about retribution, one thing I think about is, has the facility you're currently in ever talked to you about joining a resident council?
It's posted. I did attend one meeting often because it includes independent living. They have different issues. I don't feel that my experience is something that they can connect with.
Okay.
What do you wish you had known before moving into this system of assisted living, long-term care assistance?
Probably the amount of time it would take to get the financial piece worked out with the county. I first applied for medical assistance elderly waiver in August of last year, and it wasn't until April that I was approved, and it was very difficult. And there are some things coming up even now that won't preclude my access to elderly waiver medical assistance. I am on those things now, but I have to, straighten out something else. The paperwork is enormous, and if you don't have help doing it, it can be confusing. And getting the money, any retirement money or money over the $3,000 limit, and getting those in the proper funds. Even now I just shudder, because that was difficult. But as far as the facility itself, I already knew that, reading reviews was not going to be helpful. And if I wrote a review of a facility, my experience is not going to be like anybody else's. I'm very individual, and people have different expectations. I think because I was a nursing assistant, I know how much better things should be.
You talked about how it could be done better. I'm wondering if you feel like the connections you made with residents that your aides take the time, do they take the time to build with you?
No. As a resident or in TC as a patient, I do try to connect with the various staff by, asking about, about them, and, do they have children or family, where they went to school? Do they have any other goals? And I also like to express how much I appreciate what they're doing and how I know what a tough job it is. And I think that makes an impression that, I've been through it. I said, look, not that much has changed. You're overworked. You're underpaid. You're, working a lot short staff, and it's not an easy job.
So you've been on both sides, the giving and the receiving of being a nursing assistant. If you could give one piece of advice to the next person coming into long-term care at the assisted living level, what would that be? What would that piece of advice to the next resident be?
Well, before they're coming in, I would say plan ahead, because you have to deal with finances and looking at, your abilities and interests, goals, resources, to see how those line up with the various facilities you're looking at, making sure to, take a visit with, a couple family members or close friends, people who know, who you are and what will work. I mean, I may think I can do something, and then my sister would say, Peggy, you haven't done that in 2 years, or, something like that. And I thought, I shouldn't do that. And, just thinking about, you're not going to do this or that anymore. But here, look at this. That's good. You're able to do that. And I've made, recommendations for activities and talking to different staff people about those. And it's also nice if when you're visiting a place to go during lunchtime, and so you can get a meal and see what the food is like, and talk to the director of culinary services, and that worked out very well for me, because I'm a vegetarian. I want to make sure they can accommodate me.
Yeah, that sounds like great advice.
Now, I'm wondering,
that was advice for residents and families looking at facilities. What's something that you wished you could train providers on, direct care staff, about?
Well, if I could do it without them getting angry, I would say get off your cell phone. And that is something that's disturbing when they're giving me care and they're on their cell phone the entire time. And I even reported somebody recently, and she came back the next day and she was angry. And I I was afraid to respond. And she said, I was not. And I said, well, yeah, you were. And then after that, I just let her rant for a while. And she left. And she also told me she never worked with me again. And I said, okay. But now she's back working with me. They adhere to the schedule. I'm disturbed by the lack of skill and, you know, service providing. And I don't know if it's because staff just don't know any better, or they're just going by what works with everybody else, or they're just lazy. I really don't know. But it seems like women are, you know, have different needs than men in terms of cleaning themselves. But like after going to the toilet or being assisted with a shower and washing the peri area has to be done in a specific way. And that's rarely followed here, which is why I've had several urinary tract infections, which has sent me to the hospital and then rehab for 5 weeks or worse. You know, that's an important piece. And then having staff that will observe something. I've only had one aide here. She actually was the one who gets confused about medication, but she notices saying, Peggy, I see this red area here. Is that okay? Does it hurt? Or she's noticing dry skin and, you know, well, let's put some lotion on there. My mother was in this nightmare of nursing homes and TCUs back in 2009. And I remember one time when she had been complaining about her butt hurting. And I noticed two aides who were going to turn her in bed. And I said, would you check this? I think she might have a bed sore. Oh, it's fine. I said, no, I'm pretty sure something's going on back there. Can you, you know, take another look. It's okay. And so I went and I, you know, went right up to the aides and I said, that's a bed sore. And I was told, oh, we're just going to slap some cream on it. It'll be fine. And it's just shocking to me what can happen. One time I went in this place, my mother's dentures were in a specimen cup in a bedpan on the floor. Another time that there were two, you know, really big, strong men who they were going to transfer her from the toilet to her wheelchair. The commode, it was 8 feet away from the wheelchair. They didn't even bother to think about moving them, you know, close together so they could just pivot her. So they dragged her 8 feet to get back to her chair. I mean, there's a lot of thought to what, and I don't know. Sometimes I just shake my head, but if I say something, it kind of frightens me. And sometimes I can't stand it anymore. And I will say something to either the director of nursing or the nursing staff. And it just seems like nothing's done. Or if I report somebody, they'll say, well, we'll look into it. But if there's any, you know, retraining or whatever needs to be done isn't being done, or at least where their learning is not being used.
And it sounds like this most recent grievance that you had actually came back in the form of abusive behavior on the aide's part.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry that happened to you. That really is uncalled for.
Well, I think another thing that's really problematic is that they do not follow procedures with them having to do, they're not following the care plan for, you know, things like, you know, toileting, walking, transferring, you know, turning me in bed, my foot soaks and compression garments. And I thought they were just, you know, not doing it for whatever reason. But I later found out that they're recording, they are doing it, and that's disturbing. Things like using the electric lift, is there are explicit instructions posted on the door that was developed with the physical therapist, and they're not adhering to any of those steps, and it creates a dangerous situation and very painful. Like one time, they did not check the battery beforehand because there's been a chronic problem with, you know, not a backup battery, not being charged long enough. And so often the staff would have to, you know, go down the hallway, even into another unit to get a fresh battery or charge what they had. And this one morning, I didn't even ask anymore to check the battery before you bring it in here, because that was not well received. So as I was, they were getting me up off of the toilet, and I'm in this belt, you know, hanging there. And she said, oh, it's not working. So she had to go. And there I was alone, hanging from this machine. My shoulders were hurting. And because it wasn't locked, I was any time I would try to move, it would sway me back and forth. And I had four times I had shoulder problems because of that machine. One time the belt that they put on me that then attaches to the machine to help raise me up was so high up, I felt I was being strangled. Another time with the belt, when they were putting it on, they were not paying attention, and it me in the face, scraping along my eye. I've been poked in the eye twice. I've also noticed that some of the aides, if they're frustrated with, you know, somebody, then they get that just kind of messes with their whole day. So then it, with me anyway, I'm getting treated roughly. It's not like I'm being punched, but I think roughly is probably the best word way to describe it.
On around May 26th, I believe, you had told us in a kind of pre-conversation to this interview that you had filed a complaint with the Department of Health about that lift that you just talked about and being left in it and being hurt when they maneuvered you out when the lift wasn't working. And I just want to know, since May 23rd and filing that complaint, or May 26th, and it's June 23rd today when we're recording this interview, have you ever heard a word from the Department of Health regarding your complaint?
No, I have checked mail today, but so far I've not heard anything.
Okay.
No phone calls, no mail.
And I want to go back to the earlier issue when the aide came back in after you'd complained. How, as that aide is in your room, in your home, angry at you for expressing a concern about care, how did that make you feel at that moment?
Oh, it feels, first I'm sad, and then I'm angry, I'm concerned. I do, as the aides are, getting more and more upset, and I fear for my safety, because then they become negligent. I'm not saying all of the aides are there, some very good aides. It's like, any job you work, some people are very good, some people are poor workers, and but most people are in between. But I think because this is, healthcare with a vulnerable population, you have to be a special person in order to handle the stress that goes with a job. And I think there should be better training in, not just being able to take a temperature, because whatever they've learned is not right. And there's so many things that, should be done a certain way and are not.
Right. Well, Peggy, I want to thank you for sharing your stories with us today, helping everybody that's out there listening to us see a different picture, a different side to a vulnerable adult living in an assisted living situation. And
well, thank you for having me. And I would like to mention that at one facility that my mother was at, not only did she lose 20 pounds in 3.5 weeks, and the director of nursing expressed concern that she did not have a plan. When my mother moved there, she had a bed sore the size of a nickel. Within 3.5 weeks, that bed sore was 3.5 inches in diameter. It went down to the bone and it was necrotic. And I still cry when I think about what she had to go through.
I hope by you sharing your stories with us today that the listeners will take heed and follow your great advice that you gave.
And I want you to remember that pain that you still feel about your mom, and I'm hoping that you don't carry that with you as guilt, and that realizing that you were a strong advocate for your mom and what she faced and went through was the responsibility of others. And this was really moving today, Peggy, and I want to thank you for sharing. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I did forget, if you are a caregiver, there's an excellent book by Dr. Pauline Boss, Loving Someone Who Has Dementia. I highly recommend that.
Okay. Thank you.
That was Wendy. First, it was incredibly moving to hear her perspective. I don't know that I just want to, you know, sometimes I might just want to walk away with a guest, and I don't know that we'll do a wrap up, but at least talk about, there were the biggest piece in that story, or two that I take away, the actual retaliation that she faced.
Right. That bothers me the most, that she exercised her right to talk with somebody about a grievance, maybe a training issue, and how she could receive better care, and to have the aide at the facility come back and retaliate against her verbally. It just, it's astounding that this continues in 2022.
I think that's the biggest fear anybody has about speaking up when things happen.
Exactly. And that's why residents think long and hard about it before they do.
And so just informally, and we're going to address retaliation in a future episode, but even right now, some of the strategies we would brainstorm together to prevent or respond to retaliation. One, I think speaking up is important and vital. And the second piece being with it, that if I was advising someone who was afraid of retaliation, I would actually tell them to do a complaint in writing, so that there was a record of the initial complaint. And it's never too early to call the ombudsman to help.
Right, right, exactly.
And your presence in the years you were doing it, the ombudsman who are doing it now, provides kind of that third person eyes, that outside presence being involved that might minimize that and make it a safer environment to share those concerns. Maybe a family member, you know, along, you know, whatever makes the individual feel safe with doing it.
And supported.
And heard. I think facilities set the climate to prevent retaliation. Wendy, what were your thoughts? You know, she shared the story, and it was about an aide being on a cell phone. And from the perspective of, obviously it's concerning. You know, she's concerned about someone connecting with her. I'm concerned about pictures and privacy and things like that, and attentiveness to the resident. Was it necessary for the facility to share Peggy's name with that aide? Because in that particular case, it wasn't warranted. I mean, it wouldn't have been necessary.
Well, in Peggy's case, that surprised me that they would, that administration would address the concern by revealing who made the grievance, who made the complaint to the aide. Exactly. And I imagine that Peggy's not the only one that this aide ignores while talking on her cell phone and giving cares with the, talking with your right hand and giving cares with your left hand and ignoring the resident. So I imagine that perhaps administration should have gone to observe themselves so they could have a retraining conversation with that aide.
You know, and I think of the other piece in this, and it's not a solution, but it's a protective factor, would be Peggy's right to have a camera put in her room.
Yeah.
And that is an option to provide that listening eyes and ears, but some residents don't want that or don't feel comfortable with that. So that's an individual choice that has to be made. But that's an alternative as well. But that story and the other piece that came out in my mind, you know, she's going on, you know, 23 days of filing a complaint, the pain afterwards and being navigated out of the lift, and 23 days of not having heard from anyone about that complaint is concerning.
Because you have that right to make a formal complaint with the health department. It is, yeah. And for it not even to be acknowledged that it was received, or that we have this in the process and we'll get back to you. She's heard nothing.
Yeah. So, well, it was a great interview with her, and I'm really looking forward to the future stories and connections we can bring to you as we work to empower, inform, and connect you to Resources for Your Best Aging. So I want to thank you for listening today and your time. It is remarkable to be able to share in this aging journey with so many people going through it and their loved ones. And so thank you.
Thank you. Best Aging will see you in 2 weeks.